But I will say two things about Paul. One of those is that he is the author of a number of important books that have received very strongly positive reviews in science magazines such as Nature and Science, and has provided very important information for all of us and for the lay public, which I think is really great. And the other is he is an individual who should be enjoying some satisfaction at seeing a rotavirus vaccine that he invented preventing suffering for millions of U.S. children. And so let's welcome Paul Offit, a man who needs no introduction.
Thanks, Lance, and thanks both to Lance and Jeannie for giving me the opportunity to speak to you guys today, although I see I have 2 minutes left to speak, according to this, so hopefully that's not true. But and it's an honor to speak to you guys. I mean, you know, you guys are the ones that where the rubber meets the road. You're the ones out there trying to educate the public, and I'm just honored to be able to speak to you and, frankly, to be able to try and provide educational materials to help you out. But so in any case, what I wanted to talk about today is what I think is a growing phenomenon out there, which is parents who are choosing to delay or space out or separate or withhold vaccines. We're certainly seeing the consequences of that. And so what I thought I would do is sort of go through what I think are the three major reasons that people are making this choice, to go through the science of that I think doesn't support those fears, and then to come to some conclusions. So the first notion is that children simply are just receiving too many vaccines too early. Melinda alluded to this. And probably or at least a spokesperson involved in this is shown second from the left, and that's Jenny McCarthy, who during one of these Larry King shows that she was on held up a sign that listed the 14 different diseases that vaccines prevent in the first few years of life and said, this is just too many. It's more than children can handle. And it's certainly not hard to understand why she would have that feeling. If you look over the last 25 plus years, in 1980, more than 25 years ago, we had seven vaccines: diphtheria, tetanus, whole cell pertussis vaccine, Albert Sabin's oral polio vaccine, the combination measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, which meant that children could get five shots by 2 years of age and two shots at one time. But fast forward to now, you know, with the vaccines to prevent 14 different diseases, children can get 26 inoculations by 2 years of age. We switch from shots to inoculations because the rotavirus vaccine is an oral vaccine, and you can get five inoculations at one time. And I think any reasonable parent who sees their child being laid down on that crinkly white table and watch them get four or five shots at one time can reasonably ask the question, can they handle this? I mean, is this more than they can handle? I think that's perfectly understandable. I think Jenny's concern is many parents' concern and is perfectly understandable. But I think that we've, you know, times have changed. You know, we are much better at the science of vaccines. We have made significant advances in things like protein chemistry and protein purification and recombinant DNA technology, which I think has made for purer and safer vaccines. So it's really not the number of shots that you get or the number of vaccines that you get. I think the more important question is how many immunological components are in those vaccines, and we in fact have fewer immunological components today than we did 30 years ago. So if you look in 1980 at the seven vaccines that I talked about, there were more than 3,000 immunological components. And by immunological component, what I mean is a viral protein or a bacterial protein or a bacterial polysaccharide. The elephant sitting in the room here obviously is the whole cell pertussis vaccine, which was actually originally made in the mid-1910s. It was 1914 by Eldering and colleagues. And what they did was, you know, they took this bacteria, Bordetella pertussis, and they grew it up in nutrient broth, and they killed both the bacteria as well as the toxins that were produced by that bacteria and secreted into the media with phenol. That's how that vaccine was made in the mid-1910s. Frankly, the technology wasn't a whole lot better, you know, 60 plus years later. And so that was a vaccine that had actually a pretty a difficult side effect profile, and in part it was because it contained so many immunological components. But if you look now with advances, as I said, in things like protein chemistry and protein purification, depending on the particular product that's used, the vaccine contains not 3,000, but really 2 to 5 immunological components. And so if you add up really all the number of immunological challenges in vaccines, now it's actually dramatically less than was around in 1980. And frankly, it's less than was around in 1900, when the only vaccine was the smallpox vaccine, which is actually a pox virus, the largest of the mammalian viruses, and contained about 200 immunological components. So actually, although one could argue that the number 14 is greater than number 1, I would argue that that 1 contained more immunological components than we have today. And there are other reasons. I mean, certainly from birth, infants are challenged by bacteria in the environment that colonize the intestines, the skin, the throat, and that are inhaled on dust. And we've talked about this before, it's when you're in the womb, you're in a sterile environment. When you enter the birth canal and then the world, you're not. And you have literally trillions of bacteria on the surface of your body. You actually have 10 times more bacteria on the surface of your body than you have cells in your body. And you make an immune response to those bacteria. We make vigorous secretory immunoglobulin A and immunoglobulin G responses every day, really at the gram level, which is a tremendous metabolic commitment by the host to manufacturing a single protein, so we can make sure that those colonizing bacteria stay as colonizing bacteria. I mean, if you really want to scare yourself as a parent, you know, just take a swab the child's nose, you know, put it on a wet mount on a microscope slide and look at it. It's teeming with bacteria, many of which you make an immune response. And children are quite capable, babies are quite capable of making, you know, what we call T-cell-dependent B-cell responses. So, you know, they're very good at responding to the antigens like hepatitis B and Hib and DTaP and polio and pneumococcal vaccines that are given to them early in life. There was actually one great study that was done in India, probably some of you know about this, where they looked at children who were born to mothers who were hepatitis B positive, meaning the mother had hepatitis B. Those children, therefore, are traveling through a birth canal that is contaminated with hepatitis B, to the level of about 10 to the ninth, which is a billion infectious particles per ml of blood. And they gave those children only one dose of hepatitis B vaccine. There's actually two studies like this. Didn't give them immune globulin or subsequent doses. And about 85% of those children were protected against hepatitis B after receiving only a single dose of basically 20 micrograms of hepatitis B surface antigen. That's remarkable. And I think tells you how vigorous and active our immune response is, actually, at the time we're born. We get out when we're ready to get out. The second reason I think that people are concerned about giving too many vaccines at one time is the notion of an aluminum overload. And this is really at the heart of a book that's quite popular by Robert Sears, who's an MD, and I should point out to David Taylor, a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And it's called The Vaccine Book, Making the Right Decision for Your Child. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have heard of this book? Yeah, right. So there's a couple pages in the back of the book called Dr. Bob's Alternative Vaccine Schedule, where he and many parents actually will Xerox this and bring it to their doctor's office. This is a book that's got about 130,000 copies in print, and about 100,000 copies are sold. It's quite popular. There's an example of Dr. Bob's alternative vaccine schedule, but you can see that 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 12, 15, 18 months of age. And the reason for these frequent visits is shown on this slide, which is it's a quote, "The alternative schedule suggests only one aluminum-containing vaccine at a time in infant years. By spreading out the shots, you spread out the exposure so infants can process the aluminum without it reaching toxic levels." So let's look at the science of that contention that children are receiving too much aluminum in their vaccines. Aluminum is the third most abundant element on the Earth's surface and the most abundant metal. It's not a heavy metal, it's a light metal. As a consequence, aluminum is in the air we breathe, the food we eat, and the water that we drink. The greatest source of aluminum is food. Adults typically ingest 5 to 10 milligrams of aluminum per day, and aluminum is found naturally in teas, herbs, and spices. Aluminum is also added to food, such as leavening agents, anti-caking agents, emulsifiers, and coloring agents, and therefore is found commonly in things like pancake mixes, self-raising flours, baking powder, processed cheese, and cornbread. Now, aluminum is also found in breast milk and infant formula because it's in water, because it's in food, and because it enters our body. It therefore is everywhere. Certainly, it's in our circulation and it's in our breast milk and infant formulas. By 6 months of age, a fully vaccinated child will be injected with about 4 milligrams, roughly a thousandth of a gram, of aluminum. A breastfed child will ingest 10 milligrams, an infant formula-fed child 30 milligrams, and a soy formula-fed child 120 milligrams. Now, there's a big difference between being injected with aluminum and ingesting aluminum. And that is that by definition, 100% of aluminum is absorbed following vaccination, where the aluminum is injected, whereas only 1% of aluminum is absorbed after ingestion. Once the aluminum enters the circulation, either because it's been injected or ingested, it binds to transferrin and is eliminated by the kidneys fairly rapidly. About 50% is eliminated in 24 hours, 85% in 13 days, and 96% in 3 years. So it's not 100% in 3 years, which tells you that aluminum starts to accumulate in your body. So that by the end of the first year of life, a breastfed infant will have accumulated about 0.1 milligram in their body, most of which is actually in bone. Another, if you're infant formula fed, again about 0.1 milligram. If you're vaccinated and infant formula fed, it would be additive, so it would be 0.2 milligrams. And a typical adult, for example, sitting in this room, will have in their body about 50 to 100 milligrams of aluminum, again, mostly stored in bones, but also stored to some extent in brain. Now, can aluminum be toxic? Absolutely. Aluminum can cause encephalopathy, osteomalacia, and anemia in two groups. But if you look in the literature and specifically looking at aluminum toxicity, there's really only two groups in whom you find it. One are severely premature infants who typically receive IV fluids that contain aluminum, and patients on chronic dialysis who ingest aluminum-containing compounds like antacids, which have large quantities of aluminum. And really, those are the only groups you find. And you really have to have both of those criteria being met, which is decreased or absent renal function and a large source of exogenous aluminum. Now, if you look at those who have aluminum toxicity and look at their blood, typically they have between 100 to 1,000 nanograms of aluminum per ml. A nanogram is a billionth of a gram. Now, typically children, all newborn children, will have about 1 to 5 nanograms per ml of aluminum in blood. If you look at children who receive aluminum-containing vaccines and then measure their blood levels, you can detect no difference. So it still stays at around 1 to 5 nanograms. So injected vaccines do not raise the level of aluminum in blood. And this is just a list of references. Actually, on our website, which is vaccine.chop.edu, we will have this sort of aluminum what you should know on that should be available in the next couple weeks. And we'll also have a tear sheet. Those tear sheets that we give out for free should be available also in the next couple weeks. So everything that I've just said will be available on our website. Now, the third issue that people raise is that it's just too many shots at one time, that it would be reasonable then to bring a child back month after month after month to make sure that they don't get, you know, 4 or 5 shots at once, they would only get 1 or 2. And certainly there's a logic to that. There's not much data on this, but there is one study that was done by Ramsey and coworkers in the mid-1990s, where what they did was they looked at children who received 2 shots and compared them to children who received 1 shot with regard to their cortisol excretion. Cortisol is a steroid made by the body as a measure and is used by researchers often as a measure of stress. And what they found was that there was not a difference in cortisol secretion in children who received 2 versus 1 shot, which basically argues for the fact that probably children are maximally stressed out at 1 shot, and that 2nd shot doesn't do anything. But you know, you could make the argument then that by continuing to bring children in for more shot episodes, that you actually are doing more harm than good, that you're stressing them out more than if you bring them out and give them more shots at one time. So before I get into this last slide, I just where I sort of talk about how what to do next. I think there is no answer to this. I think that you know, how one handles parents who are choosing to delay or separate or withhold vaccines is a tough issue, and I think largely comes down to one's personal style. I mean, one can certainly make the argument that one should continue to work with these parents and do the best you can to try and get them the vaccines that they need, realizing that they may not or will not stick to the schedule. Because if you don't do that, then they would go to a chiropractor who will not make that attempt, or go to another doctor who will not make that attempt, and at least you're giving the child a chance to get vaccines that we know that they need. But I think there is a downside to doing it that way, and I want to go through that and then stop. Certainly, as we said, those frequent visits are difficult, I think, for a busy practice. I think, as we said before, you're more likely to induce needle phobia, which is a harm. And I think that probably the third bullet point here is probably the most important. You do increase the time during which children are susceptible to vaccine-preventable diseases. So while you're waiting, while you're playing it their way, if you will, you could see a child get Hib meningitis, which unfortunately we're seeing more now than we had before. You could see a child get, you know, invasive pneumococcal infection. And it's hard to watch that because there is no benefit to doing it that way. I mean, it's simply you're catering to an ill-founded, non-science-based phenomenon, which is that the parent is scared of vaccines for reasons that really have nothing to do with vaccines, often something like autism, which is not associated with vaccines. So I think it puts the physician or the clinician in a very tough spot. You're really being asked to practice substandard care, which may result in harm. And our hospital now, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, is now trying to, which owns a number of private practices, which are called the Kids First Practices, and involves many physicians, and roughly about 1 million outpatient visits a year, is now considering whether or not they're not going to be taking care of patients who refuse vaccines, or who refuse at least the vaccines as to this schedule. And I find that the two biggest reasons that they're considering this are, one, the waiting room. I mean, we know from that epidemic last year of measles that there was one of the children who was infected with measles, you know, went to the doctor's office and proceeded to infect other children who were waiting in the office, several of whom were too young to have been vaccinated, and one of whom got sick and was hospitalized with severe dehydration. So I think the waiting room is one reason, and because we're both a primary and tertiary care hospital, we actually see a number of children as outpatients who can't get vaccines because they're on chemotherapy for their cancer, can't get vaccines because they're on chemotherapy for their solid organ or bone marrow transplants, or can't get vaccines because they're on high-dose steroids for their asthma. So there's the conception of you know, are we responsible for that waiting room? And this, the second reason is that as we expressed on a recent conference call, you know, let me love your child. I can't, you know, I love your child and you're asking me to do something that I think could hurt them, and I just can't be put in a position to do that. And frankly, by saying, there's one of the physicians on the call said this, you know, by my continuing to see you, I'm sending a message in a sense that it's not that important to me. I mean, when I say I can't do this your way because I'm afraid that I'm going to potentially hurt your child, you do send a stronger message. And so, again, I'm going to stop here. I don't know the answer, but I think these are the issues, and ultimately it's going to be you that have to make that decision. So thanks for your attention.
Well, thank you for a very wonderful and sort of provocative set of three talks, I think, to start us on some discussion. Before we take questions, and people who are interested in asking questions, please make your way to the microphones. I wanted to go over the housekeeping so that we could have that out of the way as people are coming up to the microphone, and then we can just launch into some discussion. So the lunch rounds are going to begin immediately after the session. In the Austin Ballroom, which is across the Skybridge in the hotel. Don't forget that you must already have signed up to attend these lunch rounds, and there'll be a colored sticker on your name badge to indicate that you have a ticket to the lunch rounds. If you won't be participating in the lunch rounds, you should feel free to visit the Cyber Cafe and the Continuing Education Room, which are in Lone Star Ballroom A3 or in the exhibits at the Grand Hall. Posters are also available for viewing there during the lunch break. If you want to apply for CE credits, please don't wait until the conclusion of the conference to complete evaluations for all the sessions you've attended. We want to encourage everyone to stop by the CE room to complete your online continuing education after each session to prevent waiting in long lines. Remember to stop by the conference registration desk if you need a printed receipt for your registration fee. Receipts will be made available for printing on the internet after the conference. And the next session after lunch will begin promptly at 2 p.m., so please see pages 21 and 22 of your agenda book for detailed information. So, having got that out of the way, I'd like to ask you to give us the first question.
Yes, I appreciate all the great advice given this morning, but I wondered if any of you have worked with colleagues, if you have further insights, that refuse to follow, pediatricians who refuse to follow the immunization guidelines. In our community, for example, we have one that absolutely refuses to give Prevnar, I don't care what you say. We have two that won't give the second MMR until the child is after the age of five, and I have several that delay immunization until the very end of the recommended schedule. Polio, for example, last dose is 18 months instead of the earliest possible time. Do you have anything we can do to sway these folks besides violence or anything on that end? Because I'm a nurse and, you know, we like things done right.
You want me to take it? Wait, so you're saying but we can't do violence then? No violence?
I'm trying to avoid it, you know, being in medicine.
You know, I think we're bad at this. I mean, I think that in many ways, I mean, there's it's certainly, there are pediatricians, physicians that sort of just make things up. I mean, it's even worse than that. There's a lot of quackery and charlatanism in this country, and we're very bad at supervising that. This isn't quite at that level, obviously, but we're even bad at that. I mean, there are people in North Carolina, for example, there's a physician who, to treat autism, you know, takes urine, filters it, and then injects it into the child, and continues to do it. I mean, so it's even worse than what you described. But I think, you know, what that physician is doing, to me, is that you have a recommendation from the CDC in the American Academy of Pediatrics and the AAFP that's based on data. I mean, it's based on careful study. And it's a recommendation that therefore becomes a standard of care. To choose not to follow that standard and to put the child at risk, to me, is negligence. And were there to be a bad outcome, like the child, you know, suffered measles or worse, you know, or suffered HIB and dies, we're seeing in Philadelphia, we have six cases of HIB meningitis, three of those children have since died. You know, how do we compel that? I mean, you'd like to believe that our professional societies or our ethical societies would compel that, but we don't. I mean, and nor do our courts. I mean, you could argue that that's malpractice. You know, that when you choose not to follow a standard of care and the result is harm, that's negligence resulting in harm. That's malpractice. But you never see that wedge lawsuit either. So I all I can say is I don't think we're very good at it. I mean, David Taylor is the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Let's ask him.
Okay. we do not recommend, we haven't published a statement where we recommend discontinuing care of children because their parents refuse vaccines, and I doubt if we will publish such a statement. So we continue to hope that these parents will come around, and in my experience in my practice, they usually do come around. We have had that issue, though, where one of our partners began to waver on sticking with the schedule, and my managing partner just made it perfectly clear that we were all going to follow the schedule until there was evidence that there was something wrong with the schedule. So he put us back on track, and I guess the take-home message there would be if you found a physician champion in your community who could work with those physicians, it might be helpful. The other way to go about this is, I know different states have different requirements for immunizations, and the health director is in a position to make sure the children are properly immunized. So with some system of measurement within the state, these people would, of course, be outliers because their children are not going to be up to date by 18 months, which is when, you know, usually 18 to 24 months is when the first little survey instrument can be administered. So that would be another possibility. But it is not fun trying to regulate physician practice.
You know, can I just add one other thing? I think if, for example, a parent came in and said, and the parent had a child who had bacterial pneumonia and was agreed generally to treat with antibiotics but didn't want to treat every day because they feared antibiotics, and so wanted to give antibiotics, say, every third day, that's clearly substandard care that could have could result in that child's death. We wouldn't allow that. I mean, I think we really would stand up for that and do what we could and to maybe get a court order to not allow that. You know, it's not much different with vaccines. It's just a statistical difference. I mean, if there are parents who choose not to vaccinate, there are a certain number of those parents whose choice is going to result in suffering or hospitalization and death. We certainly saw it last year with measles. We're seeing it this year with HIV. And we do allow that because it's statistical, right? I mean, the odds are nothing bad will happen. But now that we're starting to see, for example, these HIV outbreaks, I do wonder when we get to the tipping point, when there's just a level of outrage on the other side that this isn't okay, that it's not okay to make that choice that's not science-based that could result in the death of your child. It's very frustrating because certainly the law, and Jeff Evans certainly knows this better than me, but the law is certainly all on the other side. I mean, you as a parent have the right to withhold or prevent a potential life-saving medical product that could result in the death of your child. That's perfectly your right. And maybe the answer is just is much more difficult to obtain philosophical exemptions. Maybe that's at least the start to the answer. But it's a problem, and it's not a problem that's going to go away.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right. Question over here.
I just have a comment. When I have parents that want to separate vaccines, come back 2 months or so for this second, if they have several vaccines, I just ask them which disease they'd like to put their child at risk for, you know, so I can note it down, and they always decide to give them all because they don't want to make a choice.
I'm a parent and a nurse, and I've run into a personal issue where it was kind of similar to what you said, Dr. Taylor, about. And I think the Vaccines for Children program is absolutely wonderful, and I support it 100%. However, I'm privately insured. My children are privately insured. And I had great difficulty in obtaining some of the newer vaccines, specifically the meningococcal conjugate and the HPV vaccine for my children, because the provider did not want to order that because it was too expensive. And they were not allowed to give my children the vaccine for children stock. So do you have any recommendations about how to kind of stop that trend?
That's a messy problem, and it's not necessarily the provider's fault if the insurance company is not going to cover costs. And HPV runs $120 or more per dose. So I guess if I were a concerned parent, I'd be at least calling my insurance company and saying, let me get this right. You can go on the CDC manufacturer's list price for the vaccine and come up with an idea of what you think the physician could buy it for and make sure that the insurance company is paying 17% to 28% above that, just to give you a ballpark of where you could come back to your physician and say, how about that? The other thing that some providers have done is written prescriptions for patients who were really determined to have a vaccine, so you can go to a pharmacy. Usually there's at least one pharmacy in town that will order vaccines, and then you can take the vaccine to the physician and have the physician administer the vaccine, and you pay for the product, and then you pay for the administration fee. That's a messy way to immunize people. It's a terrible way to do public health. But we're hopeful that as the federal government takes a closer look at the immunization program, and it would take somebody going in and opening ERISA and saying, your insurance companies are going to have to pay this federal benchmark for these vaccines, and if you want to use the CDC list price, fine, and you're going to have to tack on what is the proper fee for us to be able to buy it, store it, pay the interest on our loans to purchase it, and administer the program. But A lot of work to be done, no easy answer.
Yes, the insurance agency's response to me was, you have the option to change providers, which contradicts the medical home that we're trying to advocate for. So, but thank you for your comments. I appreciate it.
Okay, time for two more questions. Beth?
I just want to thank you. This is one of the best sessions ever, and I wish we could do this all day. And I think people would agree that you guys are heroes. We really... But I have another hero in North Carolina, and it's a health director in Randolph County who files criminal summons when their children, any child, is not age appropriately immunized. And she's been doing this for years. I was hoping that would catch on. It didn't, but she has been successful 100% of the time. So just thank you.
You know, can I just add one? My wife is actually in general practice and in a sort of a upper middle class community in suburban Philadelphia. And she, I would say 4 years ago, you know, tried to do everything she could just to get those children to get the vaccines that they have, and was willing to, you know, space out and separate vaccines. She was. It was taking a lot of her time. She wasn't able to do other anticipatory guidance because so much of that time was taken up by the vaccine issue, until her practice decided on its own to not accept new patients who weren't going to be following the schedule. Mm-hmm. And what she's found was interesting is it actually works better, in the sense that she felt that maybe one out of every four parents who were choosing not to get vaccines would be eventually convinced to do it her way, or the CDC and AAP's way. But now she thinks it's closer to 75%. And she thinks part of the reason is that it's not just a matter of limiting options, but it's a popular practice. People want to go to her. And it does send the message out there that this is how much I believe in this. There's another practice in suburban Philadelphia, mm-hmm, called All Star Pediatrics with Brad Dyer, who has a sheet that he's put out, and I'm sure David knows about this, and it puts it on the front of every room as you walk in, that says, you know, again, this is that important to us that we just can't do it that way. And it's, again, I think David is right in saying that you know, there is no right or wrong to this, and I don't know, but there's now starting to become, I think, an experience in doing it a variety of ways, and hopefully that experience will be studied and published.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and our final question?
I want to say thank you, too, very much, because I don't know what I would do without all of you. And just to reinforce that we need to keep to the immunization schedule that's set up for us, that is evidence-based. Right now, I'm from Suffolk County in New York, and we're having a huge problem with all the parents who opted to give single antigen for MMR. Well, there's no more single antigen around. So we went and made this decision for them, and now we look like a bunch of turkeys. Well, not me, because our health department said, no, we're not going to do that. But I'm getting the phone calls, why can't you health department people force that nasty old drug company to make us single antigens, because we're not going to over-vaccinate their children. So I'm now in the position of having to explain to the parent, you're really not over-vaccinating, because if we give MMR now, and they've had two of these, now they're going to get one of those, so now you won't have to give anything more when they go to kindergarten. But meanwhile, we've set ourselves up to look like turkeys, because now we don't have the vaccine available, because we didn't follow what you told us to do in the first place. So, you know, there's something to be said about following the evidence-based practice. And I really loved that line yesterday that we got is, I'm a scientist and I have reviewed this literature, and that's why I think this is the very best thing for your children, and that's what I think we need to do. And thank you again from the bottom of my heart, because I have things pinked out in Dr. Offit's book that I read to parents when they call me.